From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We are joined, as always, with our super producer, Paul Mission Control Deccant. Most importantly, you are you, you are here, and that makes this the stuff they don't want you to know. Folks, if you have ever experienced an earthquake, then you understand the instant chaos these can produce. In a matter of moments, ordinary life can be completely upended. And an earthquake, the actual event, may only last minutes or seconds, but it can wreak havoc and destruction that lasts for generations afterward. They're not like hurricanes. They're not easy to predict. And in today's episode, we are diving deep into the world of earthquakes and seismic anomalies. And the good news is we are not going into this endeavor alone. We are immensely fortunate to be joined today with the acclaimed actor, writer, director, and most recently, the creator of the hit new post-apocalyptic podcast, Aftershock. Please join us in welcoming the one and only Sarah Wayne Callie. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to talk to you guys.
Can I just say post-apocalyptic podcast is the best thing I've ever heard? You've coined that. That's yours, Ben.
That's very kind. We worked on that.
Post-apocalypod.
Yeah.
Okay, nope. That's the new one. That's the good one.
Wins.
Living language.
So Sarah, Aftershock, for anyone who hasn't checked it out yet, Aftershock takes place not immediately during a massive earthquake, the biggest in U.S. history, but in the wake of an earthquake. Los Angeles has been laid to waste, right? It's been flattened, and a mysterious new island has surfaced off the coast of California. Now, you conceived, wrote, directed, and you star in this story. So one of the things we'd love to begin with is to learn a little bit about what initially inspired you here. And one of the first questions we had for each other off air was this. Have you ever personally experienced an earthquake?
I have not personally experienced a big one. So I grew up in Hawaii, and because it's a very geologically active region, there are different stories that explain why. Some of those stories involve magma. That's my shout out to everybody who's missing Mike
to
Myers.
Lorne Michaels, Austin. Right?
Yeah. No, to Austin Powers.
No, Dr. Evil was like totally a rip on Lorne Michaels.
Was it really?
Oh, yeah.
On Dana Carvey's impression of Lorne
exactly.
Michaels.
Everyone has
some bad blood with Mike Myers and Dana over
Wow. Okay, that I didn't know, actually. Thank you. Thank you for that. I recently rewatched the entire trilogy, the oeuvre, on VHS. Yes. With one of my sons, which is just the greatest way.
Wait, which one's the best? Like top of your list, which of the three?
I like the first one. I do.
Yeah,
I really, really like the first one.
Classic
it's hard
powers.
To beat.
What was it, Gold Member? That was the kind of bad one, right? That one wasn't so great.
Was that the Heather Graham one?
I think so.
Yeah, I wasn't super wild about that one.
The Spy Who Shagged Me, I think, was two. That one was fun. I just remember Gold Member being
That's
like a
Beyonce.
little shark jumpy. Yeah.
Folks, let's stop the show. We need to figure this out.
Back to magma. Magma, Hawaii,
magma.
Lots of volcanoes.
That was the most amazing segue. Let's go from volcanoes to Mike Myers in zero steps.
And then back to volcanoes. Here we are.
Magma. So yeah, okay. So some people say that that Hawaii is a very seismically active area because we're a volcano, right? Like it's a volcano under the ocean and the plates move and we get islands. That's Sarah's science lesson for the day. There's also some really wonderful and amazing stories that come from Hawaiian mythology about the volcano goddess Pele and her various relationships to other gods and demigods and mortals and the way that causes movement. But yeah, so I didn't grow up with anything major. The only dramatic moment I had in an earthquake was self-imposed. It was a moment of me trying to look like a hero and looking like an asshole. So I was staying at my friend's house, John Bernthal's house, and he at the time had a kid and a baby. He was out. His wife and I were hanging out for the night. And we were in Venice, and she had just put the baby to bed and was putting the toddler down, the kid, and the house started to shake, and like a picture rattled, and I was like, oh, save the baby! And I that baby's sound asleep in the crib, right? Like, finally. I wake the baby up, grab the baby, run to the middle of the street, and nothing happens. And I'm all alone out there in the middle of the street with a baby that's like, okay, you know what? Don't do that again. And John's wife comes out. She's like, what is
Where
wrong
are
you with
going it? With my baby?
I was like, there's an earthquake. And it's Ben, you were talking before we started about being in Guatemala and like overreacting yes. to something that the locals thought was not such a big deal. That's exactly what happened to me. I was in an inconsequential earthquake and I woke up a baby to share it with me.
Oh, I have to say, I would probably do the same thing, just having no experience of knowing mm-hmm. what the fight or flight activation is in that moment.
Well, there's you two no are a very nurturing, you know, kind of caretaker kind of human, Matt. Mm-hmm. I can totally see you doing that.
Matt one time woke me up and hauled me out of my apartment.
I carried him, yeah.
Yeah. His arms.
Yeah.
Was there a quake or you were just feeling sentimental?
There was a train.
It would turn out to be a train. So this is fascinating, though, because, you know, Sarah, you're saying it was a minor incident, but I think just from that story, that experience is so profound. You know, people are used to the earth being solid ground, right? It's one mm-hmm. of the few things we can kind of count on. And that's why I think it's so fascinating. And it's so, in any other context, I would use the word grounded, but it's a grounded story to look at people and say, what happens when this thing that no one can really predict, as we'll find, how do you handle it when your entire world figuratively and literally has been pushed upside down? So what was some of the inspiration here when you were first ideating about what would become Aftershock?
Well, I mean, part of it actually did come from that moment where my rational self exited the building and my evolutionary brain took over and was like, we've got this. And like, proceeded to make a series of really ridiculous decisions. But I think we, you know, we have this veneer, and I've explored this in lots of, you know, different parts of my career. Maybe I just draw these stories to me because I'm fascinated about them. But we have this veneer of civilization and culture and politeness and ways to behave. And it's fascinating to me how quickly that goes away, right? Like, it's a patina. It's the thinnest coating on top of the 4.5 billion years of evolution that governs the rest of our behavior. And I'm so interested in who we are in those moments. Because we spend a lot of time, I think, in our lives building up a sense of ourselves. I'm a good person. I'm a rational person. I'm a calm person. I'm a sharing person. And, you know, I don't know if you've ever been backpacking and gotten lost, even for like 6 hours and the sun's going down and you're in your head going, okay, there's 4 iodine tablets. There's 6 things of beef jerky. I brought Norm with me and he eats a lot. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, all of a sudden, you start doing a radically different kind of calculus. And I also remember, and I'm not going to be able to summon the name of this book, but when I was in like middle school, we were assigned to read a book about the San Francisco earthquake. It was a novel that took place during and around the San Francisco earthquake. And it just sounded, like another country, another time. I mean, there was something, I'd never heard a story about anything that happened in the U.S. that was quite as catastrophic and topsy-turvy as what happened in the course of what, like 11 minutes or something in San Francisco.
Just a series of minutes. Yeah. And yeah. With a bit of quick Googling, let's see if we could win our gambit. I think maybe Matt and Noel were doing this as well. Is the name of the novel Vera?
No.
I think it's called Disaster.
Disaster?
From Dan Kurzman.
We're all going to give me. I want to say it like took place in Chinatown.
Okay.
Clearly the content made more of an impact on you than the title, and that is absolutely fine.
Well, I was also like 11, which
Oh, yeah. Which yes. Was like, okay. It was The Giver. That was
Outrun the Moon. No,
we're gonna keep this. Is gonna drive me nuts. I'm sorry, guys.
Oh no, it'll come to you. And
it sucks
care
to like
anymore.
Reference yeah. something and then.
No, it will come to you and you don't care anymore. Mm-hmm. It'll be like an aha moment at the end of the episode. And yeah, it'll be like totally like the big payoff.
And the audience will write in as well.
That impulse that you're describing—not impulse, but that like fight or flight thing—that moment where you know it's do or die. Like, okay, I am lost in the woods. I can survive for X number of days given these circumstances. Your mind does make a shift and you can feel it. And I feel like we all felt it like the day that everyone found out, we're in a pandemic. This is real. Mm-hmm. You described, we did a bonus episode for Aftershock, which I had the pleasure of executive producing for iHeart, and I got to moderate this bonus episode. And you described the moment that everyone collectively experienced when everyone's cell phones start lighting up and everyone's like, okay, this is real. You immediately booked a flight to Canada, I believe, and you got out on one of the last flights where you got there and it was like, sorry, folks, no more flights in or out. We've closed the border. And you described that in such cinematic terms, just literally on that episode, just describing this real moment that happened to you. And it's very similar to kind of what happens in the first episode of Aftershock when the quake hits, you see the actual moment, you're kind of popping around the different characters. Again, it is very grounded in just the day-to-day lives of these characters. And then you see them all have to kind of band together and through various ways come together and kind of like, you know, survive and create this new world, this new colony on this island that comes up. But how weird was it for you to kind of see those parallels? Obviously, you wrote this, you know, far in advance of this real life kind of apocalyptic event happening to us as a species. What was it like to you to kind of see those parallels? And was it like super trippy?
I mean, I felt a little bit like Nostradamus. And one quick point of clarification, I booked a flight to Canada because I live in Canada. There may be some people listening who are like, weird, there's a pandemic and she decided to go to Canada.
Get me out of here, Canada.
I booked a flight home. I was retroactively grateful for the care we took with the epidemiology.
Sure.
Because we had a lot of conversations about, okay, there's a virus. What does it mean? How is it transmitted? I decided to base it on AIDS in terms of transmission. Mm-hmm. Also, you know, I kind of grew up during the AIDS crisis and I remembered kind of how that, you know, tore the community apart. It was very weird to have written something that I thought was fiction, that I was reaching into the depths of my brain just for a device that would allow us to ratchet up the stakes so that we could play with these characters' interpersonal dynamics, right? Like, I don't care. Yes, it's a show about an earthquake, and yes, there's a pandemic in it, or there's a virus in it. But to me, that's just so that I can put human beings in difficult relationships with one another and see if there's a way for them to find some kind of redemption.
I love
there's
that you
so
say
much
that.
Bleakness right now. Mm-hmm. I feel like there's dare we call it an epidemic of bleak storytelling in television and film, and it's starting to shift. I think actually with things like Rutherford Falls and Reservation Dogs, and you know, things that are really rely on humor and connectivity, and maybe
the Ted Lasso effect is what we're calling it.
Yes. Yes, totally. You know,
we need that. But you're right. I mean, your characters are all moving towards some kind of positive outcome, and there it's all about perseverance, about pushing forward and, like, you know, taking advantage of those moments, not letting it crush you, not letting it, you know, deprive you of your humanity, but like making it bring forth your humanity. And that's what I was kind of getting at. I think you do a fabulous job with that character building within this world that is just sort of a frame to play with these incredible characters that, I mean, you know, in an audio podcast, it's not easy to do, to give so much life using only your voice with no visuals. And obviously the sound design, super important. And on Aftershock, it's incredible. But the acting is so good and the writing so good and the storytelling is so great. It's just, I highly recommend, give this one a pause, go listen to an episode, and then come join us for the magic of podcasting.
Yeah.
But
that's
just
amazing.
Anyway.
One thing I would say to add to that, and this is something I was thinking over as I was, I think experience is a good word, a good verb to use here. You're probably, if you're listening to Aftershock, you're experiencing it more than you're listening, because it's compelling. It's, it brings you in. And I think it's because so much emphasis is put on the humanity here. And I noticed that in your work on Colony and your work on Walking Dead and your work on Prison Break and so many other projects, that is one of the great thematic commonalities. These people find themselves in unexpected, extraordinary circumstances. You know, sometimes the folks that you had just thought would always be your enemies become, you know, allies, and the negative of that happens as well. This seems to me to be a common thematic thread. And I have to wonder too, in your writing process, which I'd love to talk a little bit more about, in your writing process, did you find any moments where the characters themselves surprised you? Like where they made choices that you didn't see coming?
Yeah, for sure. I definitely did. I mean, I think we're all super familiar with the version of humanity that's the Lord of the Flies version, right? Mm-hmm. We've all understood that narrative that things can go south and we can all turn into monsters. But I think we're maybe less familiar right now with the ways in which sometimes in disaster, people do remarkable things for each other. And selfless things for each other. And some of the reporting of the earthquake in Haiti, you know, they talk about people giving everything that they had to strangers who had lost everything and knowing that they'd never see it again. You know, just somebody passing through who's hurt and barefoot and lost their phone and their wallet, and just people whose homes had been destroyed, giving them everything they possibly could and sending them on their way. And I think those were the moments sometimes where characters surprised me a little bit with the need for connection, the need to feel like, well, we're two beating hearts in the world right now, and we might both be scared, but at least our hearts can beat next to each other, and we can maybe get through it. I was not sure at all from the beginning how I was going to get Michaela and Cassie to some place of peace or redemption or forgiveness. That was a question from the beginning that I kind of had, and I wrote a lot of versions of their two big scenes. And it took me a long time to kind of talk my way through it and find a little bit of grace between them. And I think sometimes the grace is actually in between the lines. It's not in what's said, but it's in kind of how you hear it, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it does. And this, I promise, just one more question about the writing process, because I am fascinated here. Okay, so the one thing that differentiates Aftershock from a lot of other fiction stories of this world, you know, regardless of medium, is the approach you've taken in terms of this narrative structure. So we experience multiple voices, multiple characters, and we're often experiencing something that they are looking back on. Benefit of retrospect, there's a flashback that occurs, and it unfolds the story in this really compelling way. Did you set out with this approach in mind? And if not, what led you to this innovative approach? Like, I feel like it does a tremendous job of world building, right? Which can be a challenge sometimes, and this nails it.
Oh, thank you. I think it came from two things. One, Malcolm Gladwell did this really fascinating podcast episode on his show, Revisionist History, about Brian Williams and memory. And in it, he talks about the ways in which we can be 100% sure that we are remembering the absolute truth, and we can be 100% wrong. And so, and especially in a crisis, when your blood is rushing in your ears and your heart is pounding, and that reptilian brain is at the helm and not, you know, your sort of prefrontal cortex. I think our memories become subjective. And then a lot of the narrative structure of it, of this sort of true detective style question and answer interview period, a lot of it came from a need to convey certain kinds of exposition to the audience without wanting to start every scene by being like, ooh, it sure is cold here on July 19th in the 5 days after the earthquake. And oh, look at that.
Holds
it's a
up
battleship.
Newspaper. Yeah.
Exactly. Exposition is, you know, it's hard, and especially without a visual, to be like, remember, guys, we're on an island and LA's in the distance and it's burning.
Oh man,
that was helpful to have somebody asking questions who's an interrogator.
And just really quickly, just to add, and then I'll move on as well. Your sound designer Jeff Schmidt
is a
who's also worked on shows like Dr. Death and many others that folks would have heard of. He talks about how he created that sense of depth of field, like a cinematic kind of approach to audio storytelling, where he would have things in the foreground and the background, but in a much more clever way than just like, here's birds chirping and like, here's the person's really close and this person's really far away. He literally created a sense of focus and depth that you would usually only be able to achieve visually with like camera focusing and rack focusing and things like that, and the depth of field of the camera. He did that with audio, and I think that's really what like took it to the next level, especially in the pilot when like the earthquake is actually going down. It really is, it feels like you're there. It's like some of the most immersive sound design I think I've ever heard. Really, really excellent.
Jeff Schmidt is a god. I mean, it's phenomenal what he did. And also, I think some of it came from just my own ignorance. I'd never written for audio before. So I'm just writing an earthquake. And he's like, what does that sound like? I was like, I don't know. You tell me. And he'd be like, okay. And then he would come up with stuff and we'd play with it back and forth. And, you know, I stuck people on opposite sides of like plexiglass and then I put hazmat helmets on folks. And he was like, what do you want this to sound like? And I was like, I don't know. Just good. I want it to sound good. And so he had total free reign and I wasn't smart enough to write something different, I think is the truth of the matter.
I'm just imagining a bunch of people in a studio wearing hazmat suits with plexiglass and they're just running into it to try and get some kind of earthquake sound out of the plexiglass.
Yeah.
It's like when you shake the piece of metal to make like thunder sound effects or whatever.
The Foley artistry.
Yeah,
you're not that far off though, Matt. Actually, one of the actors, because they recorded this whole thing during lockdown, had like new baby, I believe. He recorded in the trunk of his car.
What?
In order to get the best isolation, and then had to like text his wife to come let him out when he was done.
What?
He couldn't find any peace and quiet.
No. That's amazing. That's amazing.
It was amazing.
Okay, wait, hold on. I'm just trying. Was that David? Was that David Harbour?
No, it was Rocco Dunbar. He's got four kids.
Oh, wow.
So, oh, my God.
And they were in full lockdown. So he went into the car, and then we were like, what sounds really... like, there's a lot of bounce. He's like, well, yeah, I'm surrounded by glass. And he goes, wait. And there's this, like, shuffle, 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 crunch. And we're like, oh, that sounds great. Where are you? He's like, I'm in the trunk. Can we do this really quickly? I was like, yeah, man.
I can't breathe.
Full commitment. I love it.
And that's something that, a lot of people in the creative fields have experienced, you know, in lockdown, in the case of podcasting, you know, thousands of shows ended up moving from studios to, I saw a lot of walk-in closets, I think, and then some that were just maybe called walk-in closets. And there was, because, you know, you walked in with a microphone. And this, to me, in a way, that speaks to the earlier point you made, Sarah, about how in adversity, we sometimes forget that people do rise to these challenges. Mm. And you see some of the most noble, I'm not connecting podcasting with a pandemic or a natural disaster, hopefully, but we see people rise to sometimes the best version of themselves at the times when it matters most. And that's something that, again, I'm trying not to spoil too much, but that's something that I find uplifting about the story of Aftershock, is that it's not, you know, when people hear the term post-apocalyptic, sometimes they think perhaps a little too quickly of things like The Road or Mad Max, you know, which is very, very gloom and doom. And what's another thing that I thought was so grounded with Aftershock is something that we wanted to chat with you a little bit about today, which is there are, I imagine, some similar real life events, not on the level of something destroying Los Angeles yet, knock on wood and fingers crossed, but the largest earthquake in U.S. history is oddly enough, often forgotten in the current day. And this is the New Madrid. We pronounced it correctly this time, Matt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we did. That's it.
The New Madrid seismic zone and the massive earthquake that, not figuratively, but literally shook the continent back in the 1800s. When you're doing research and you're thinking through, okay, what is the epidemiology of something? What are the effects of an earthquake of that magnitude? Was there anything you found that surprised you? Because, you know, none of us are seismologists. So we're not experts on what happens after an earthquake. As you know, I experienced one in Guatemala and nearly peed myself to the amusement of a very nice host family. But what did you find, and how did it inform the way you tell this tale?
I think Matt's helping us out a little bit now with the dog noises. No, but so seriously,
dogs are very, very, very prescient. Dogs can predict earthquakes, so we better.
They felt they were feeling it. Yeah,
they feel. You talk about an earthquake, the dog starts barking. Mm-hmm. But no, yes. I mean that surprised me, the way birds will change their behavior, dogs will change their behavior. You know, I think you even sent me an article about the Missouri earthquakes, that birds will flock to people, dogs will often run away. You know, that we think of these things as much more of a surprise maybe than other animal life who are, yeah, like, I have been trying to tell you for the last 18 hours that this shit is gonna blow. That fascinated me. I mean, the big thing was the whole premise of the show was brought to me by Ben Haber and Patrick Carman. They had this idea, what if a new island rose up out of the ocean? And my first question was, well, how? And I got on the phone with a friend of mine who very luckily happened to have worked for the U.S. Geological Survey for years. And I was like, okay, so is there any world in which an earthquake could like push up a new island? Like, I realize this sounds ridiculous. I was like, I did a little bit of internet research, but I never know if that's BS. And he's like, I mean, it's possible. I'm not going to say it's going to happen, but it's possible. And so we went from there. But that was the big surprise to me, is that there can be kind of geological events miles away from the epicenter that are so still so profound.
Oh, yeah. We're going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back. And we're back. I want to jump in here to talk about some of the weird stuff that happened during those earthquakes we're mentioning here, the New Madrid fault stuff, the stuff from the 1800s. One phenomena in particular that was seen then, 1811, 1812?
Mm-hmm. Yep,
were
that's correct.
Strange lights in the sky as the earthquake is actively occurring. This to me feels very science fiction. That doesn't seem real. Doesn't seem like that's something that would happen. Why would movement on the Earth, on the Earth's crust, cause lights in the sky to occur? And it's still honestly something that the scientific community is a bit, there's debate still about what exactly it is, but there's some pretty interesting concepts. And the reason why I want to bring this up is because that happened in 1812, 1811, in September of this year in Mexico, in Acapulco, there was a large earthquake where you can see video from the city of these weird blue flashing lights going off all along, all in the sky as the earthquake is actively occurring. And you could
I'm
see
putting that in season two. I'm taking notes. About, this is brilliant.
Okay, well, it also gives us a fun new word, seismoluminescence.
Yes, exactly.
Super wow.
Yeah.
Seismoluminescent. That's a six-syllable word right
there. Now I'm going to have a hard time saying it ever again. But Matt, if I'm not mistaken, it has to do with crystals in the Earth's crust being squeezed by the fault activity and literally causing lights to shoot up that can appear almost as like squiggly snake type things. And then they're so bright, they actually do kind of create patterns in the sky. I know there are like sort of, it's still the jury's out on some of this stuff, but is that roughly what you're talking about?
Yes. You have to kind of describe a little more there. Sometimes it's balls of light. Sometimes it is squiggly things like you're talking about. I think they're referred to as streamers. Sometimes just a glow, almost bioluminescent, like glow that kind of brightens. Yeah, very weird. And it's tough because you have to imagine all that stuff is occurring, but you've also probably, very likely, if there's an electrical grid anywhere nearby, you're seeing some transformers blowing up out in the distance and seeing flashes of that. You're seeing, other parts where there is electrical wiring that's malfunctioning and sparking, as well as maybe buildings that are just having issues and fires starting. So all of these different lights happening while the earth is shaking, to me, it's just, I don't know. It feels very otherworldly. And I can imagine if you weren't armed with that information at hand that you could recall very quickly, and maybe you've seen several movies where something like aliens are involved, let's say, or, the apocalypse, and you see all of this happening, you feel the ground shaking, your mind is in that place that we're talking about, that would probably be one of the most terrifying things that could happen to you.
Oh, yeah. I disagree with you, Matt.
I would also add that from what I understand, people still aren't 100% sure what can cause earthquake lights. There are a couple of competing theories, hypotheses, and that just makes it even stranger. Because let's be honest, when everything goes sideways like that, hopefully not literally, but maybe sometimes that's the case, and you see those lights, can you really blame people for thinking, yeah, fine, aliens, why not? This is just not my day. That seems very human and understandable. And then to learn that people, experts who spend their lives researching this around the clock, still aren't sure. To me, that teaches us that there is a lot more to learn about earthquakes. And that kind of knowledge, I would argue, is only going to be increasingly important in the coming years, especially now that we know fracking can indeed cause earthquakes.
Yes, it can.
By the way, the idea that that was news to the fracking industry just seems so weird to me. I'm like, oh, really?
Buy that.
Yeah. You needed a study to tell you that when you fracking is an earthquake. It's one of those things that
we are on the same page. Sarah.
Makes me a little crazy.
Well, there's a bunch of these seismic anomalies and phenomena that are associated specifically with the New Madrid event of the early 1800s. Another one of them is called a sand boil, where basically weight from high river water pushes down on the layers of soil underneath it, and the water can find these weak spots in the soil, and it seeps up to the surface, and it actually looks like the sand is kind of boiling up out of the ground. So again, think about, this is the 1800s. People are seeing this.
It sounds like Revelations.
That's what I'm saying. I would think the world was coming to an end. People were thinking they were going to get raptured.
Straight up.
It's weird, too. Nobody died that we know of.
One person.
One person died, correct. And there were maybe some missing folks where they didn't find the bodies. And that's another crazy one that has to do with these fissures that can just open up, sinkhole style.
Yeah.
And just literally swallow you into the depths of the earth. Which means that, because maybe lack of record keeping then, or maybe things that got lost in the chaos, maybe there were more people that were killed than just the one person that we know of. But all of this stuff taken together with the limited scientific knowledge that they had at the time, I think would have made for some real nightmare fuel.
Well, and it feels like a religious experience, right? I've never seen the Aurora Borealis. That's on my bucket list. But every time I see a photo of it, I was like, well, that's magic. I'm sure there's science behind it. I'm sure people have studied this. But I was like, no, that's just magic. And that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. And if that was accompanied by sand boiling up from the earth and the earth shaking, and because the other thing was the Mississippi River reversed direction for a second, right?
Right.
Started flowing in the opposite direction. Again, the rational, college-educated part of me would probably leave the building and, in her place would be, caveman Sarah. Being
Yeah. You'd want to find an island you could escape to. A newly formed island.
Right. And then even to that point, you know, it's there are different kinds of intelligence, right? We're different people mm-hmm. depending on the context. So if you have already experienced perhaps one of the most traumatic events of your life, and then in the case of New Madrid in 1811 and 1812, seeing a river literally flow backwards is going to give you some real serious questions about spirituality. And we know for a fact that this was the case. And I think it's also very realistic in Aftershock, the way that we have some people who, for better or worse, have turned to spiritual answers to explain what has taken place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I always want to make room for both. One of my really good friends in Vancouver is a bishop in the Old Catholic Church, which is like not the Roman Catholic Church. It's like a thing, the capital O, Old Catholic Church. And we have different relationships to a lot of things. But whenever I'm trying to create something to write, I want to make sure that the bishop and I can both participate in it and not feel judged. Like, I feel like there's so much, and this is a little soapboxy and I apologize, but much division of like people of faith are stupid or like people who believe in science are being lied to. And there's just this, it's a different approach than the one I grew up with, which is sit down, break bread, have a meal together. You don't have to agree. You just have to be kind. You have to be nice to each other. You have to be respectful of each other's different opinions. And I think it was important to me in Aftershock that there were some people who took this as something deeply and profoundly spiritual. And it can be if that's how it affects you, right? If you change the thrust of your life and personality in response to something, then in your life, it has become a spiritual event.
Absolutely.
And you know, then there's another explanation that has to do with science and refraction and plate tectonics and things like that. But it would be awfully nice if we could find ways for things like that to coexist without screaming judgment at each other. I'm just
agreed,
tired of that.
100%. It's a false dichotomy, you know? It really is. If I could accompany you on the soapbox, you know, I think one of the things people forget is... Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me. It's one thing that far too many people forget is that science at its best attempts to answer how something occurs, right? And spirituality is concerned with why. And those are two incredibly noble and I would argue equal endeavors. And the idea that I think perhaps for some people it is a mean-spirited comfort of sorts to dismiss those sorts of philosophies that they may not personally ascribe to. But I also think those people are shortchanging themselves because ultimately both of those questions are continuing endeavors, right? Not people haven't all decided to agree on one spiritual belief any more than seismologists have been able to successfully predict an earthquake. Science is still asking how, and spirituality is still the quest to answer why. And with that in mind, like I think that's, not to fanboy too much, but I think that's something that's really brilliant about the characters in this story, because having those viewpoints, having those differing perspectives, it makes people feel more real. Because even folks who don't openly talk about that probably deal with the same dilemmas, I would say. Okay, I'm off the soapbox.
Hey, Matt, you just went for a book. What book did you get?
Oh, I did. This is something my grandfather gave me. It's called Remembering Socrates. You probably can't even read it because of my crazy ring light. But it has some interesting things in there about how we as humans like handle our belief in God. But one of the major things that it hits on is the Socratic method, which is what you're talking about. It's really just listening. When you're talking about sitting at that table with people who have differing beliefs, you got to do more listening than talking. That's the way you actually grow. In my opinion,
really,
that's just, sorry, that's what I was reaching for it.
Well, no, it's interesting, too. The spirituality kind of enters into this when we're talking about the New Madrid earthquakes. Right before the earthquakes happened, there was this crazy comet that was visible around the planet for 17 months. And it actually was at its brightest during the earthquakes. And it was referred to, it's been referred to as Napoleon's Comet in Europe, but it was actually called Tecumseh's Comet in America. And Tecumseh was a Shawnee First Nation tribal leader. And he had a brother who was referred to as the Prophet. And he was really good at foretelling events. Like, you know, that's how you get a nickname like the Prophet. He apparently predicted a total eclipse of the sun that happened in 1806. And then on September 17th of 1811, there was another solar eclipse, which he had predicted. And that kind of preceded the earthquakes as well. It's a whole thing. And then there's another story about how the Mississippi running in reverse was seen by the Muscogee tribal members as a sign from a river god called, I believe, like the Thai snake gods, I think what it was called, as a sign that they should rise up against the European colonists who had like kind of changed their whole way of life, and that it was a call from, you know, beyond the veil to like return to a simpler way of life. And long story short, they did rebel, but word got out and they kind of got quashed, and it ultimately led to the ejection of all these First Nations people from the area. So essentially, it led to the Trail of Tears. So this spiritual interpretation of a natural phenomenon led to this shift, not only, you know, tectonically, but like historically.
I didn't realize that's real.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The comet was visible for that long.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
It hadn't been seen previously. It's one that's just like out there and it orbits. And I think it had been seen previously in the time of Ramses in ancient Egypt.
Most comets are just out there orbiting. Yeah. You know what I mean? You don't know what their circuit is except
that's
for
right.
you.
Yeah.
But I think that's compelling, right? Because again, to the point you made, Sarah, there's not a reason to denigrate somebody's personal spiritual interpretation of a thing. And science and faith do coexist and have for years, right? The origins of science are rooted in philosophical things that might be considered spiritual today. And maybe to what you were saying earlier, it takes some people, sometimes it takes a massive unexpected event to bring that to bear in their own, you know, in their own, what would you call it, front of mind, for them to admit it. We'll pause for a moment for a word from our sponsors before returning with more from Sarah Wayne Callies. And we've returned. With this, I've got to say one of the strangest aspects, and I'm walking a line here because I don't want to spoil it, and I want to make sure everybody, if you didn't pay attention when Noel earlier said pause this and go listen to Aftershock, do that now. We're not going to spoil it, and you'll be glad we didn't. But this brings me to ask one thing I know our audience is going to want to ask. So season two. What are we? Is there a season two on the way? Are we thinking that?
There's a season two on the way. Noel and iHeart just kind of dropped us a pickup recently. I had not thought much about a season two when I was writing season one.
Oh, man.
Earthquake lights. Yeah.
Yeah. Earthquake lights are a huge part of it. There will be sand boils.
Maui. Maui shows up. Are we familiar with Maui?
Moana? Are you talking about The Rock?
Yes. Yes, because we're gonna incorporate Hawaiian mythology and Disney, I guess, apparently.
But actually, I think that's not, I mean, not to tell you how to write your season, but
no,
I do think, you know, you're already talking about all this. At the top of the show, you were talking about Pele and the Hawaiian mythology that informed your kind of childhood growing up and your understanding of all this seismic stuff and the volcanoes. All the stuff that I think that I was just talking about with like the First Nations folks and, you know, the predictions and the comets. And I'm so fascinated by all of this lore and like, maybe it's real. There's a part of my brain that wants to believe that. There's a part of all of our brains that want to believe there is magic in the world. And I think that's why the idea of an island rising up, yeah, can it be scientifically explained? Sure, maybe, as your friend from the Geologic Survey said, but what if there was, what if it was more like, you know, there was some magic behind it, you know? I think that's maybe something to think about, just putting in my two cents for season two.
Well, and I mean, you know, we have Lelehua and she's there mm-hmm. for a bunch of reasons. She's there partly because, you know, I have an agenda about Hawaiian sovereignty, having grown up there and, mm-hmm. and was really moved by what's going on with the Kapu Aloha and the protests up Mauna Kea.
Yes, I was just in Hawaii. Yeah.
Were you? Yeah. I mean, what's mm-hmm. going on Hawaii Island is extraordinary. And in some ways, I think an outgrowth of things that I got a chance to observe and listen to when I was growing up. But I think, look, maybe part of why I believe that these two worlds can be kind of straddled when it comes to traditional mythology and science is that that's sort of how I grew up. I mean, when I was in fourth grade, we went to Hawaii Volcanoes National Park, and it was on a different island than the one I grew up on. So they send you a list to pack because you're going to be there for a few days with your fourth grade class. And you're going to Halema'uma'u Crater. And on the packing list is an airplane bottle of gin to throw in the caldera as a gift to Pele. I don't think they do that anymore. This was eons ago, and they probably don't want people littering. But there was this conscious sense that you don't show up to the volcano without an offering to the goddess who it belongs to. There was a conscious understanding that this is not your land. This is Hawaiian land. There are people, there are gods who inhabit, gods and goddesses who inhabit this land, and it's on you to learn the stories so that you could behave the way you need to behave. You know, I never took a hike without making an offering at some point, just of, hey, thanks for not wiping me out with a flash flood. I'm super grateful. Thanks for not dropping a rock on my head. And it was weird for me when I came to the mainland. And, you know, I went to school in New Hampshire. And I was like, so whose land are we on? And people were like, what do you mean? And sorry, when I say white people, we're like, what do you mean? Right, but
specifically,
you know, I mean, there was no sense of those stories. And so part of having lay in aftershock is like, well, let's write those stories back in because they're interesting. They're powerful. They shape who we are. Growing up with an understanding that one of the most powerful forces on the land I was growing up in was a female deity. I think mm-hmm. probably there's a direct line between that and me being a director. You know, like, yeah. Those stories are important. I think they're important. Mm-hmm. And because I get to write Aftershock, I get to make them important. And there will be a lot more of that. Maui is an interesting idea, actually, because the story of Maui, you know, and his brothers is the story of Maui pulling up the Hawaiian islands from the sea. And, you know, maybe I can convince Dwayne to come and
yes.
Do a little dance.
Do it. Get Jermaine Clement in there.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Well, can you imagine? We'll sing about Mr. Johnson, hi. Can I? No, $500. No, 500. Just dollars. Dollars, not million. Yeah, just
it's
dollars.
It's a podcast. Do you know it's what a podcast? Have you listened to a podcast?
But you can do it from your closet.
Uh-huh. Yes. Or the trunk of your car.
Are you still there? Mm-hmm. Are you still there?
No. You can also communicate these stories in a way that they may not have been encountered before, which I think is both unique and powerful. I also do want to add for the skeptics in the crowd who are saying something like, oh, well, you virtually would never find an island rising. They all come from somewhere. And people may be surprised to learn that as recently as August of this year, just last month, new islands were being discovered. There was one just found off the coast, like slightly above Greenland. It's the most northernmost island in the world so far.
Awesome.
Yes, way. Yeah. So the world in which we exist outside of the realm of fiction or podcasting has all of these amazing things going on. And I love the idea of the rich mythology being brought to bear here. And also, yeah, it would be nicer if people on the mainland had at least a little bit of something in the direction of that philosophy that you have described, you know? I'm going to be thinking about that off air for a while.
And the great Atlanta Falcon first came. No, I don't think we can do it.
I don't know.
Charleston, the Wind Eagle, you could get there. Mm-hmm. You could get there. Is that a Cherokee myth? I can't remember.
Oh.
If it's Cherokee, then Cherokee country is close enough to Atlanta that you might be able to get away with the Wachowson myth.
Oh, yeah, man.
I'll be honest. I know more about that than I do the Atlanta Falcons. I'm embarrassed to say.
Is that basketball or? All right. We'll figure it out.
I think it's water polo.
Does Atlanta have a hockey team? Tell me they have a hockey team.
We did once.
Once upon a time, the Atlanta Thrashers.
The Atlanta curling team?
We're holding out hope. Our petition has not been answered. But, of course, you've got to shoot your shot. And at this point, we do want to note, as we said in the beginning, that currently scientists cannot successfully predict the day and time of an earthquake. Instead, what they can do is they can make models based on past events, and they can explore things like seismic zones and fault lines and predict areas where, just like aftershock, they can predict areas where earthquakes are likely to occur. And this is something that can alarm people sometimes. There are a lot of factors at play. You know, Sarah, you mentioned earlier, we understand that when the plates shift, right, that's when it can be earthquake time. But again, for this story, and I believe for many people who have survived events like this in real life, the thing that stays with them are those human moments. And that's what I would posit, that's what all amazing stories are ultimately about. When you get down to the interactions, the triumphs and the travails of the characters. So now that we know a little bit about season two, which again, no spoilers yet, we have to ask, Sarah, because the audience is going to ask us, where can our listeners go to learn more about your work, and where can they go to learn more about you?
To learn more about my work makes it sound like I have an oeuvre.
You do. It's tough.
Yeah, you haven't really done much, right, Sarah? Nah, you haven't been in all things.
Where can they go? I mean, I don't know. You can follow me on Instagram, but
it's a good follow. Highly recommend.
Oh, hey, thanks. You could do that, or you could. I think some of my stuff's on Netflix. Some of it's someplace else. I don't know.
You never know these days. Things are always hopping around all over these different streaming. It's like basically like cable all over again, but like way more confusing. At least then it was all in one, on-demand menu. Hey, let me hype man you real quick. I'm just going to say you can also listen and subscribe to Aftershock on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Do that.
That's
thing
what I should have said. Sure. That right there. Mm-hmm. That's it. Yep. Yep. Just ask Noel.
I got you. I got your back.
Nice. You guys, we didn't even talk about like the nuclear threat of earthquakes in the Midwest.
We can. I mean, that's a good way to. We talk about the future of things. I mean, that's sort of a good place to leave folks, I think. But
that's terrifying. Fault,
it is. Like, that fault we talked about is still a thing. The New Madrid fault.
Specifically because FEMA and the United States government, the Pentagon, they back 10 years ago, I think, 10 years ago, they had one of the largest test runs essentially of a huge earthquake. I think an 8 or 9 on the Richter scale earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
And they had thousands of emergency responders modeling what would happen, right? If just all of the buildings collapsed along this area. And the worst part is that there are so many nuclear facilities out there that if one of them was affected to the extent that the Fukushima reactor was affected, we could essentially, I mean, just think about the radioactive fallout, not only along the land in terms of a possible explosion, but also aquifers that are deep underground getting that radioactive wastewater in them.
Oh my God, the Mississippi.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
It doesn't matter which way it's going. If there's radioactive wastewater in there, no bueno. Anyway, it's FEMA and the Pentagon have been thinking about that for a long time because they're aware it's not an if thing, it's a when thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's a terrifying thought because I feel like we spend a lot of time thinking about the military and war games and the threat whether it's China or Russia or someplace, you know, Iran, North Korea, the idea that the entire country could melt down from the middle with some like chain reaction of nuclear reactors, that's like, that's a disaster too big for Michael Bay to make it a movie. You know what I mean? Like, there's just no, there's no wrapping your head around that.
I disagree, though. I think Michael Bay could explode way more things in his movies. He's
calling
back
a geological
so much.
Survey right now. Yes, Michael Bay, famously subtle filmmaker, known for his nuance. If you want to read that study in full, folks, you can, by the way, find it online. Everything Matt just described is factual. That's on, you can see it, I believe, through the U.S. Geological Survey.
Yep. Wired has a great article called Pentagon Quake Nightmare Fukushima on the Mississippi.
So at the very least, maybe it's something that will inspire you after you listen to this episode to go find your loved ones. You don't have to explain yourself because you love them. Just give them a hug. And have to have some positive energy for them here. Sarah, again, thank you so very much for taking the time to be with us here today. We can't wait for everybody to hear Aftershock. And we're also going to ask, what do you think, fellas? Let's ask our fellow listeners here to give us maybe their stories of earthquakes, their stories of surviving related disasters. We would love to hear from you, and we try to be easy to find online.
That's right. We are Conspiracy Stuff on Twitter, on YouTube, and on, what's the other one, guys?
Facebook.
Facebook. That's the one. We also have a Facebook group called Here's Where It Gets Crazy. Just answer one simple question. It's not a riddle. It's all very straightforward. Just say the name of Ben, Matt, or myself, or just say something to let us
or
know
make
you're not
us
like
laugh.
A Russian bot yeah. and that you actually listen to the show great. And you're in. Great memes to be had, great conversations with great folks. If you don't want to do any of that stuff, you can also give us a telephone call.
That's right.
Telephone. Our number,
right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
The telephone?
You use your mouth and one of these, and you can talk to us.
Through this ancient technology. Yes.
through the Black Mirror, we exist. So our number is 1-833-STDWYTK. That's just stuff they don't want you to know, all the first letters. You can leave us a message for 3 minutes. That's what you've got. Please give yourself an awesome, awesome nickname. Don't tell us your real name.
It can just be middling. It's no pressure.
It can be related to Native mythology, Hawaiian mythology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it could
whatever
be nuclear
you want
meltdown.
It to be.
yes.
It could be blueberry pomegranate. We don't care.
Michael Bay's
We're excited
nuclear
about
meltdown.
It.
Michael Bay's nuclear meltdown.
That's what they call it when he pitches a fit on set.
Oh boy.
Yeah. Oh, so just Michael Bay on set.
Michael, you can call us too if you want.
Yes. So,
it's going to take him more than 3 minutes to say what he has to say to us.
That's right. Hey, and if you, like Michael Bay, need more time, please instead send us a good old fashioned email. We are
conspiracy@iHeartRadio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.